Key length is a big deal. I mean, a lot of people make a real big deal about it. The basic reason key length is important is that to break a lot of systems, you can search every possible key. So the thought is that, think of a normal house key. There are four pins. There are about 10, I think there are 10 positions each pin could be in. So there are 10,000 possible keys for any brand of lock. That's as many there are. So if you're a burglar, you can actually stand in front of the door with an enormous key ring and try every possible key. And you will get into the house. Right? On the average, you'll try 5,000, then you'll get in. Now, the reason nobody does that is because it's incredibly boring. You're going to have to go to the bathroom. It takes a long time. But incredibly boring is what computers are really good at. So a computer will think nothing of trying 10,000 keys. It might take a millisecond. You know, they'll think nothing of trying 2 to the 40th keys. Now, they'll of a billion, 10 billion. So you need to make your keys long enough to avoid what's called a brute force search, trying every possible key. So that's sort of the meta, what's going on there. Now, that's not everything. So there are lots of other ways to break into a house. You can actually pick the lock. You could throw a rock through the window. So there are lots of attacks into cryptographic systems that have nothing to do with key length. So key length, while important, and I hate it when the press does this. They love to compare key lengths. 128 is better than 56 bits, or 1,000 is better than 500. It's true, but it's really not terribly relevant, because there'll be a length by after which it doesn't actually matter. So what's important is not only how long the key is, but what the algorithm looks like, what the lock technology is. So there's really two parts to looking at a crypto system. Now, to your question is, what's long enough? Well, that's a moving target. We sort of know what's too short, right? We know 40 bits can be broken in software in, relatively short order, probably real time in hardware. We know that 56-bit DES can be brute-forced by an EFF cracker machine or anyone else willing to spend $250,000, actually less now they did the engineering. Now, for every bit of key you add, it gets twice as hard. So with 56 bits, I think EFF did it in 23 hours. If you have 64 bits, multiply that by 256, and you have how long that takes, or multiply your budget. You can play with various factors, or Moore's Law tells you what time length. And you can sort of see what the minimum key length required for adequate security. Right now, my guess is about 90 bits. Now, that's right now. If you're securing something that you need to be secured for 20, 30 years, you have to extrapolate out technology. Once you start getting into numbers like 112 bits, triple DES, 128 bits, IDEA, the AES candidates, you're getting into numbers that aren't possible to brute force break with physics as we know it. You need computers that require more matter than we have in the solar system. That even with, looking at quantum mechanics, the switching times, even getting down to the theoretical minimum, will take longer than the age of the universe. The power required is more than the output of a supernova. Again, looking at quantum mechanics. So there are bit lengths which physics as we know it just can't deal with. And there are bit lengths where even quantum computers can't deal with. The real thing to look at, making your keys longer is not necessarily a good idea. You've got them at 128 bits, that's fine. Probably forever. Until computers are made out of something other than matter. So that I think that answers your question. It's probably longer than you wanted. But it's worth thinking about. Something over there. I can't hear you because of the music. Speak louder. The question is about encryption horsepower due to the encryption. This is actually interesting, and it's worth talking about. For brute force attacks, for searching key space, every bit you add doubles the work. And the question was, what about for actually doing legitimate encryption? If I'm encrypting with a 64-bit key, and now I encrypt with a 128-bit key, how much harder is it to encrypt? And it really goes up linear with the bit length instead of exponential, which means, you know, technology is on the side of the cryptographer. So if you're going to double your key length, let's say with RSA, it might take four times as long to encrypt, but it might take, you know, 10 to the 80th times as long to break. So generally, and you'll hear the cell phone industry likes to claim this, that we can't do encryption with large keys because it'll take too long. They're basically lying. It's basically the same amount of time. There's not going to be much difference. There's someone over with you, you saw. All right, let's talk about quantum computers. Two things. I'll talk about quantum computers and quantum cryptography. Quantum computers, a few years ago, a physicist named Peter Shor showed theoretically that you could build a quantum computer. He had no clue what to do with it. It couldn't actually do anything useful, but you could, in theory, use the superposition of states, quantum states, to build a computer and do calculations. Turns out the first thing you can do with it that was useful was factoring large numbers, break RSA. The second thing you can do with it that was useful is do the discrete log problem, break every other public key crypto system. Now, this is just theoretical. I mean, this is really on the lunatic fringe. You're right. I think we have a quantum computer at Sandia that can add two-bit numbers. And that's what we have now. So is it 10, 15, 20 years? Don't know. It is certainly possible that within our lifetime, factoring large numbers will become easy. Easy such that RSA will not work with any key length. Now, for symmetric ciphers, the best, theoretically, that a quantum computer can do is increase the speed of a calculation by a factor of a square root. So if you have a calculation that's 2 to the 128 bits long, a brute force of a 128-bit number, you can bring it down by a factor of square root, so 2 to the 64. So if you have a key length that's 256 bits, which is what the AES candidates right now are requiring, even a quantum computer, that drops that down at 2 to the 128th steps, it's still well beyond the reach of physics, at least for our species. That's a cool question. Question about AES. Anyone following AES? I'll talk about AES. DES, Data Encryption Standard. In the 1975 or so, the National Bureau of Standards went out to the world, I guess the country, and said, we would like an encryption standard. Give us some ideas. They got a lot of really stupid ideas. They got one good idea that was called DES. Lots of things happened. DES became a standard in 1976 for 5 years. Every 5 years since then, it's been renewed as a standard, less because it's still secure, more because of the legacy applications. It's all over the banking industry. It's all over everywhere. There's a lot of legacy DES out there. Finally, 2 years ago, National Bureau of Standards, who had become the National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, somewhere in the process, decided to replace DES with a new federal standard encryption algorithm, which is called the Advanced Encryption Standard. They had a couple of meetings trying to define the rules of the game, send out a call for algorithms. Let's see, where year are we in? We're in 99. In 97, the rules were published. The submission deadline was June 98. They got 15 submissions, if I remember correctly. Kind of neat, from all over the world. The majority were not American. So when the government says that we can't let encryption technology out of the country, it kind of makes no sense. There were submissions from Australia, Japan, Belgium, Costa Rica, Canada, lots of places. Basically, it's one big demolition derby. We all put our algorithms into the ring, and we insult each other for a while. Last one left standing wins. My gang submitted an algorithm called Twofish, which is one of the contenders. There have already been two AES workshops, one in California last August, one in Italy last May. NIST says that sometime this summer they will pick approximately five, that's a direct quote, so five more or less, semifinalists. And then there'll be another year of demolition derby. And then NIST will pick, get this, approximately one winner. They are really hedging their bets. This is a phenomenal process. As a cryptographer, this is the most fun we can possibly have. There's a whole lot of new targets out there. Counterpane Systems, my group, has been publishing breaks left and right. We're doing really well in the demolition derby. I don't know how well we're doing in the contest. In the straw polls at the AES workshops, we come up in the top five very easily. We are the fastest across platforms. We certainly have the coolest name. We have the least corporate annoyances. But the second round is coming. I can probably list the five that'll be on it, but I probably shouldn't. And then we have another year, and they'll pick one. It's a good algorithm. Right? The NSA is being really cool about this process. They're not screwing with it at all. The question in the beginning was, should they submit an algorithm? I kind of wanted them to, because I want to see what they do. They decided not to submit because the NIST wanted to keep them in their back pocket as an evaluator. What NIST hopes will happen is that we as a community will pick a winner. NIST will show the NSA, and the NSA will say, yeah, don't worry about it. Right? If the NSA says, oh my God, just look at this, and shows us something classified, NIST will have a real problem. You know, for this to work as an internet standard, we all have to buy into the process. And so far, we all have. But it could go sour. I suspect it won't. NIST is doing really well. But what's probably going to happen is, in another year, we will have a new encryption standard that is royalty-free, public domain, and that the cryptography community likes a whole lot. And that's a good thing. Over there. The question was about DNA computers, right? Yeah, and applications in cryptography. They don't really have any application. Well, I mean, in my book, I sort of imagine DNA computers doing brute force, and still, you just can't get the economies of scale, because even with large amounts of, I mean, you have DNA oil slicks over the 100 square miles of the ocean. You can start doing some math, and you're still not going to do a lot of these brute force calculations, and even that's really on the lunatic fringe. Something less on the lunatic fringe is using DNA to solve NP complete problems, traveling salesman problem, and also some of the problems used in public key cryptography. Len Edelman, who's the ANRSA, has done some work in that. And, you know, the answer is maybe. I certainly wouldn't sell my stock based on it. But, you know, you want to watch these technologies, because when you're doing security, you're looking into the future. You need to extrapolate out Moore's Law. Now, unlike any technology, cryptography is needed as a technology, as a military technology, because of the way it goes back in time. If someone invented a new type of gun, they can fight the next war better. But if someone invents a new cryptographic attack, they can go back in time and read stuff that's happened in the past. And that makes it unique in military technologies. So you always want to pay attention to stuff on the lunatic fringe. I mean, it's on my radar, but I'm not losing sleep over it yet. Sure.
What's the future of X.509?
Future of X.509? You don't ask that in the other room? What's the future? Okay, what's the present of X.509? We're going to talk about certificate authorities. This is actually interesting. Right now, there are many companies that are making a living selling certificates, basically selling a bucket of bits which binds your identity with a bunch of information, usually a key, that's signed by some trusted, whatever that means, third party. And these are thought to be the enablers of electronic commerce. And this is the reason that VeriSign has such a ridiculously high stock price. The question to ask is, does that actually make any sense? Now, you can open your wallet, and there are any number of credentials in there. And they work basically the same way. There's some tamper-proof process to produce a credential that's certified by some authority. My driver's license is a tamper-proof to the limits of those guys in the corner over there. Binding of your name, your photo, your address, etc., certified as authentic by the state of issue. Your passport is the same thing, certified by your country. Your library card, your credit card, your frequent flyer cards, your Starbucks frequent coffee drinker cards. All of these are secure credentials. And you could envision doing analogs of these on the net. So in order to access a certain website, you would need a government issue age verification credential, which would be in the X.509 format. See, X.509 is just a format, so I'm actually answering the real question. The future of the format is probably going to be around forever, but that's actually not interesting. So VeriSign says in their model, you're going to have one credential for the net, for everything, and it'll be good for everything. Now, if that was true sociologically, you'd think you'd have one credential in your wallet. I mean, all those credentials really are is a pointer into a database. That's all a credit card is, that's all a frequent flyer card is, that's all a library card is. It's just a pointer into a database where all the information really is. Now, there's no reason in the world why your frequent flyer number can't be your Visa number, can't be your library card number, can't be your driver's license number. There's no reason why you can't have just one card. The reason you don't is, one, marketing. People want to own the space on the faceplate of the card. And two, the rules of issuance, of use, and of revocation are different in each one of those circumstances. Visa wants to issue its own cards under its own liability models. It doesn't want the state issuing driver's licenses that count as Visa cards. American Airlines wants to issue its own number because it has its own rules of when they issue. They're much more lax than getting a Visa card. And they don't want to have to deal with Visa's rules. So everyone's got their own rule set. And my belief is that eventually, where eventually might be in terms of years, because we're still shaking this out, your virtual wallet will be as rich as your physical wallet. It will have all sorts of credentials used for all sorts of things. And that's what will happen. So the format will survive because it's a convenient format. But the paradigm of one certificate that's good for everything is just plain ridiculous. I mean, it makes no sense at it whatsoever. So I hope I did that. I'm going to get one on this side. I'm probably not going to do mathematical theories on stage. I'll do basic concepts. No, I'm not going to do that. We're negotiating questions here. I can't believe this. You in the way, way back with the tall hand that's up there. This is time for quantum cryptography. Quantum cryptography, do you mean quantum doing the key exchange over quantum channels? Okay, actually, that I wanted to do that before in the previous question. This is not a lunatic fringe. You can actually build a public key system based on quantum mechanics. The sort of the 30,000 foot overview is you can exchange information over a quantum channel such that if an eavesdropper eavesdrops, by the laws of quantum mechanics, he will be detected because he will change the system. So you can check for that and you can make sure your stuff is private. This has been done. A bunch of lunatics at British Telecom have done quantum key exchange over 10 miles of fiber. I mean, this is real. And the question is, when is it going to become actually useful? My belief is approximately never. Not because it's not interesting, not because it's not doesn't work, but because it requires a lot of special equipment. Right? And the thing about mathematics is it works on anything. The annoying thing about quantum cryptography is that you need the quantum cryptographic hardware to work. So you might see it in certain special cases, but as a general purpose things, math is so much more resilient to changes in hardware. Yes? Can I speak to DPA? I can, and that's actually a question deserves a t-shirt. I've got to give more of these out. I have to throw them better. DPA is differential power analysis. Let me talk about the general ideas of a secure perimeter. Many security systems are based on the notion of a secure perimeter. What this is a tamper-proof module that is given to you by somebody else that you can't open that holds some of their secrets. So a good example would be a smart card. Smart card, which is a digital cash system. There's a balance in that smart card. And if you could get in that smart card and change the balance, well, that would be fun. You could mint some money. So logically, there's a branch office of the bank living in that card, living in your wallet. Now, how good is that? I mean, if we can do that right, that seems really neat. We can do a lot of cool things. We could put branch offices of everybody in your wallet. We could put branch offices of the cable TV company in your TV decoder sitting on your set-top box. It would make it a lot easier to do purchasing things, and in fact, the satellite companies do that. Now, to me, that's a real interesting paradigm, and I don't trust it a lot. Now, there are a lot of secure perimeters out there, and they're actually terribly useful. You know, go across the street to the Hard Rock, and you'll see slot machines. It's a great example of a secure perimeter. If you can get into the slot machine, you can make a lot of money. But the slot machine is in public, and there are lights, and there are cameras, and there are people, and there are guards. And if you get anywhere near that slot machine with a drill, you're going to be tossed out of the casino and tossed into jail. But what if the Hard Rock said, hey, you're a good customer. Here's a slot machine. Go take it home. Play with it for a month. Keep it in your basement. We don't care. Bring it back. Whatever on the pay line, we'll give it to you. It's a secure perimeter. We trust you. Now, suddenly, that's a very different value proposition. Because you could take it home, and God knows what kind of microscopes and electron tunneling equipment you have in your home. You can get the design specs of the safe, of the slot machine. You can take them apart. You can practice. You can learn. You can do lots of things that you couldn't do when the machine's in public. So the requirements for the secure perimeter, for the slot machine that's sitting on the casino floor, and the slot machine you take home with you are very different. And probably you can't build a slot machine that is secure against anybody from this room being allowed to take it home. Because remember, we don't have to be secure against the average. We have to be secure against the best. The average is not going to try to cheat the system. Only the best will. Okay? So I'm still going. This is a good one. So that's the notion of a secure perimeter. Now, there are many smart card systems that use this notion anyway. And there turns out to be a lot of ways to break secure perimeters on smart cards. And one of them are generic, what I call side-channel attacks. Normal cryptanalysis, you know the algorithm, you know the input, you know the output, and you try to break it. And if you can't, the algorithm is secure. But what if you knew some data about how the algorithm worked? So the algorithm is running in software. Maybe you knew the hamming weight of the registers at certain times. Or maybe you knew the timing. Or maybe in power analysis, you knew the power consumption. And using that kind of data, which is actually relatively easy to get off a smart card because it has no power supply, you're feeding it power anyway, you could learn a lot more about the internal workings of the smart card chip than the smart card manufacturers normally thought you could. And as it turns out, you can break a lot of things with power analysis and differential power analysis, and there are many forms of power analysis. There are lots of papers on this now. We've done some. Paul Kotcher pioneered this. Some people at RSA Labs have a paper in the fall on this. Turns out you can do a lot of neat cryptanalysis using different side channels. And again, this is yet another reason why this secure perimeter notion is very dangerous. I like secure perimeters. I use them in designs, but I don't rely on them. So I hope that meandered through your question. I am going to go into the back. Way there. No, it is you, not behind you. Yes. No, don't turn around. Stand up. What are my thoughts on elliptic curve cryptography? Why don't you come and take a T-shirt? That's a good question. All right. Public key cryptography is basically, all public key systems are based on one of two problems that are more or less the same. The difficulty of factoring large numbers and the difficulty of computing discrete logs in a finite field. If you don't know what that means, don't worry about it. You don't have to for this explanation. Those are the hard problems. As it turns out, when you get a new technique to break one, you can apply it to the other, at least so far, and it seems like that'll be true forever. So most of our public key systems use large fields in the rational numbers. So the numbers mod n, where n will be a 2,000-bit number, between 0 and the 2,000-bit number. Or discrete log systems might be in a field of 1,024 bits. So what that means is the math is being done in effectively very large clock arithmetic. Now, elliptic curves is just another finite field. I mean, that's all it is. And you can do all discrete log systems, actually even RSA, in the elliptic curve finite fields. It's the math is just different, but the theory is exactly the same. The question is, why might you want to? Well, as it turns out, most of the best factoring algorithms we actually, all of the good factoring algorithms we know, the quadratic sieve, the number field sieve, and all the variants, use a notion called smoothness, which I'm not going to define. It's a mathematical notion. They use the smoothness of the numbers in order to work. Now, in the elliptic curves, in the elliptic curve field, there is no definition of smoothness. So, because of that, the best discrete log and factoring algorithms don't work, and therefore, you can get by using shorter keys to get the same level of security. Okay, that's the only benefit for using elliptic curves. Okay, so the question to ask is this lack of notion of smoothness, one, a fundamental mathematical property of elliptic curve fields, or two, a hole in our mathematical knowledge of them? It's either one or the other. Now, I very strongly believe it's two. That eventually, or eventually could be defined in 50 or 100 years, someone will invent a notion of smoothness, and that means all of the good factoring algorithms apply, which means there's no benefit in the world to using elliptic curves. You might as well use regular. Until that happens, in situations where key length is very important, smart cards, very small devices, pager, you know, whatever, where 1,000 bits of RAM is a big deal, elliptic curves make a lot of sense. For long-term secrets, they make no sense. I mean, there's no possible advantage except if key bits are dear. So that's my rife on elliptic curves. Wow. Oh, who do I want? I will take the person who's right there. You, yes. I don't want to do another quantum question. I actually don't. It's to other topics. Up front, in the blue shirt. I'm going to talk about, okay, questions about steganography in existing systems. Yes, there are lots of products out there that do steganography. I recommend you shouldn't use any of them. Steganography is one of those technologies which is extremely oversold. And this is part of my general, you know, how to think about security, right? We've thought about security in secure perimeters. We've thought about security, one of the other questions, you know, how do we think about security? Let's think about steganography. What steganography basically is hiding of messages. So we can take a message, which could be encrypted also. It doesn't actually matter. So let's assume it's encrypted or not. You can hide it in other messages. You want to hide it in things that are lossy. You want to hide it in audio or audio files or graphic, pictures. Photographs, digital photographs. Thank you. And you can transmit them over the net such that nobody knows you're transmitting a secret message, right? They think you're just transmitting a picture. Now, this is extremely dangerous. Let's think about when we might want to use this. We're going to use this in an instance where the adversary is so draconian that just the fact that we're speaking in an encrypted message is enough to make the secret police knock on our door. France has turned around. You ask me about France later. China. You know, really repressive countries. So how do most people use a steganographic system? They download the application. They download a picture of a giraffe. They put the message in a picture of a giraffe. They send it to their friend. Their friend reads the message, puts it back in the picture, you know, writes a reply, puts it back in the picture of a giraffe, sends it back. You know, now the secret police says, these guys are sending the same picture of a giraffe back and forth many times. What do you think they're going to think? Moreover, the low-order bit of the giraffe picture is changing all the time. Isn't that suspicious? Now, this kind of brute force attacks on steganography can happen. If you pull any picture off a website, someone can, and send it, an attacker can intercept that and just run a compare across all the pictures on the web. You know, maybe they're organizing them by general topic, looking for the same picture with a low order bits difference. So the kind of power relationship that usually goes on means this doesn't work. Steganography only works when, while using it, you don't change your communications patterns. Right? I've never sent a GIF in my entire life. If I send one suddenly, if I start sending them 3 times a week suddenly to someone else who has no apparent reason to receive them, anyone who's watching is going to get suspicious. The steganography is not going to help. The suspicion will be there. So you better have a plausible cover story. If you're a photojournalist that regularly sends new photographs across the net to your publisher, steganography, it will be a pretty good solution for you. If you're not, it's less likely to be. So in steganography, for it to work, you need a cover story. I did a whole essay on this topic for Amnesty International, because they were using this stuff. And there, it's a really big deal. And I'm very worried about steganography as a tool, because it gives a false sense of security that isn't there. Oh, my heavens. All right, James. When is cryptography going to hit the masses? I guess there are two answers. One is it already has. Right? Every time you use an ATM machine, the link is encrypted. Every time you use pay TV, the link is encrypted. In Europe, all of those smart cards are encrypted. Cryptography has hit the masses on the net, SET, SSL, all of these sort of baby protocols that everyone's using. People are using cryptography every day. They're not realizing it. But what it's not doing is it's not protecting their personal privacy. It's being used to facilitate commerce. So the real question might be, when is large-scale user-controlled cryptography going to hit the masses? And that's a big open question, right? The government will hope never. I'm going to hope tomorrow. You know, the truth is going to be somewhere in the middle. It's tough because a lot of the systems we have now expect the user to be intelligent. Right? This is really a problem. And it's actually a subtle problem. You know, if you're using Netscape Navigator, you can set your security level, you know, low, medium, and high. For most people, that is equivalent to setting the annoyance level. Now, how many annoying error messages do you want? And users can't be expected. Yeah, and this is a great Butler Lamson quote. He'll talk about users surfing the net, and they'll click on a picture of dancing pigs, and a Netscape dialog box will come out. It says, "Warning: unsecured Java application. Do you want to see the dancing pigs? Yes, no." The average computer user will pick dancing pigs over security every day, and you can't expect the user to answer that question intelligently. It would be like buying a car, and whenever you went into third gear, it would say, you know, "Warning, this is third gear. You might get in, this has this problem, this problem, this problem. Do you want to go into third gear? Yes, no." You know, a car manufacturer would never do that, because product liability would never allow him to. But because software is exempt from the Uniform Commercial Code, they can get away with doing stuff like that. So as long as security requires active intelligence by the user, you're not likely to see it ubiquitous, because users don't have active intelligence. You need it pervasive. Now, there's no reason why Microsoft couldn't make it pervasive in MS Word. One, you know, they don't want to because they're too brain dead. Two, the government regulatory structure makes it hard for them. Export controls makes it explicitly hard for them to export, so they have to maintain two code bases. And sort of general behind-the-scenes pressure by government means they don't do it domestically, because, you know, they're in enough trouble with the feds. They don't want to get into more trouble with the feds. So there's a lot of subtle pressure to play ball, or, you know, not to install good ubiquitous cryptography. Now, this is political. This is not technological. We can solve this problem relatively quickly if the environment allowed us to. So we're working on changing it. There are many laws running through Congress, actually crawling through Congress, And maybe in our lifetime, one of them might be passed in some form or another. You know, we're always hopeful, but it's hard. If you want privacy, you can get it. You just have to actually work at it. And that's really too bad. All right, you're the one whose hand is wiggling. See, move your hands. I'll notice them better. Coolest thing in the last 8 months. You know, God, someone asked me that a few nights ago, and it took me a long time to answer, and I can't remember what I said. Kind of sad, isn't it? All right, okay, so quick question is what's going on that's cool right now? AES is cool right now. A lot of the stuff in side channels, I think, is real cool. What we're seeing generally is people stretching the envelope of what constitutes a valid attack. You know, there are attacks that involve breaking the rules. This is a lesson I learned a few years ago when someone from the NSA, whose name I won't give, was talking about something that had happened, and he mentioned a type of attack. I think it was calling and getting a key, making a phone call. And I looked at him and said, "Oh, come on, that's cheating." And he gave me a look that said basically, "Are you from Pluto?" And in fact, he's right. In cryptanalysis, there's no such thing as cheating. And we're seeing bunches of attacks that break the rules, that don't follow the same model. Now, what can we do if we get control of the things you throw in your trash? Turns out you can do a lot. You can send people things to decrypt. They don't decrypt properly, and the person throws it away. If you can get at it, there's stuff you can do. There are attacks I can do against certain. We did a paper on this. Is Ian here? Yeah, with Ian Goldberg. Looked at some of the coding theory algorithms where you sent messages to the recipient. You had a target message you wanted to break. You sent messages to the recipient which were slightly off from the target message. And depending on whether the recipient could or could not decrypt it, you would learn information that helped you break the original message. Really slick attack. All right, some of the other cool things we're seeing are some of the good protocols. Really good public processes for designing secure protocols. IPsec is a great example. The Internet Traffic Level Security Protocol. So that's kind of cool. What's coming at Krypton? I haven't seen the program for Krypton 99, so I actually don't know. There were actually a bunch of conferences around that time. Adi Shamir's Twinkle device was neat. And this is a hardware device that sped up factoring for 512-bit keys. It doesn't scale very well. Actually, it scales pretty poorly. But it means smaller keys are vulnerable sooner than we thought. And I heard a rumor that some academic is actually going to build one of those, I think at MIT. So that's kind of neat. Now everyone's waving their hand. Now the person whose hand isn't waving gets noticed. Oh, talk about France. This happened a couple months ago. France completely reversed its position on cryptography. 180 degrees. Basically, now cryptography up to 128 bits is legal without a license. Anybody can use it. And they're in the process of making all cryptography legal. This happened about 2 months ago. One of the back issues of my newsletter gives the pointers to the French documents. This is really good news. It makes the U.S. more and more of a pariah on the world stage. Yeah, France is now one of the good guys. Who knew? All right. Talk about the Wassenaar arrangement. I'm really bad at it. Unfortunately, I don't follow it as much as I should. Basically, this is the all of the good countries getting together and denying cool technologies to the bad countries. That's sort of basically what it is. You know, we won't sell China our cool submarine propellers, right? And we won't sell them our cool cryptography. Many countries have signed this, and when you read it, it's really not that onerous. Software, publicly available software, or public domain software, is all exempt. It's really very targeted to military technologies. United States is trying to push much stronger cryptography rules, leveraging the Wassenaar arrangement. And there has been lots of debate back and forth on what this means. You know, countries are changing a lot. UK used to be one of the baddies, and they became one of the goodies, and now they're sort of backsliding a bit. Sort of hard to tell where they are. You know, Australia and New Zealand have always been pretty good. So, no, I don't follow it as much as I should, so I'm sorry. My newsletter. There are flyers out there. Just go to counterpain.com, and it's a free monthly newsletter. And, yeah, please subscribe. It's actually fun. There are back issues on the net. The two-hand wave. They're going to be juggling soon if I make them do different things each time. Digital watermark. Another good topic. Come up and take your T-shirt. All right, this is another how to think about security. Let's talk about digital watermarking. Basic idea is we're going to embed some sort of watermark into video or graphic image so that when you start pirating The Little Mermaid, Disney can come down on your butt. And, you know, that seems like a good thing. The problem with this is it doesn't act, you know, who are we, go give it back, give it to somebody else. Who are we trying to protect against? You know, are we trying to protect against grandma who wants to make 10 copies of Little Mermaid for her grandchildren, or are we protecting against the Taiwanese pirates? Now, against grandma, pretty much anything works. A big red warning sign says, do not push this button, will work against grandma. Against the Taiwanese pirates, pretty much nothing works. Because the watermarking system, for it to work, there has to be verification engines. These will become public. The Taiwanese pirates will get them. You guys all know how easy it is for this stuff to get out. And once the Taiwanese pirates know what the watermarks look like, they'll be able to get rid of them. So sort of the basic moral, and you know this from copy protection. I mean, most of you know how futile copy protection is. When you give a smart person a bucket of bits, he is going to remove whatever controls you put on that bucket of bits because he has way more time than your engineers do. And he's probably smarter too. And the Taiwanese pirates do hire the best because there's a lot of money in pirated Little Mermaid copies. So watermarking works against just the population for which you don't really need it. And against the population you really care about, the professionals, watermarking doesn't work. So that's really my problem with watermarking. And you know, there'll be some sweet spot for which it actually makes sense, but it's not going to be very big. And companies like Intertrust, I just don't buy their business model. Music is the same thing. I mean, the professionals will be able to pirate because they'll be able to pull the watermarks out. You know, these days, it's actually very easy to pull out watermarks. The ones coming on will be a lot harder. Now, watermarks, they have to be at least similar enough that the same software, you can't develop a new system each time. What if you don't care about what? Yeah, but it's really not going to work. The other way to do it, especially for music, is, I mean, you've always got the D to A to D solution. Right, you know, you take the watermark CD, you play it, and you record it again. You do it 10 times. You have a computer, you know, filter out the noise because you've got you can get pretty much perfect without the watermark. There are a lot of paths to the unmarked copy. And you know, for data, it'll never work. You just fish it off the screen. All right, I have 5 minutes, so now they're standing. All right, the person waving his hand with something in the hand. Current state of subliminal channels. Subliminal channels, you guys might have used them in Back Orifice is one god-awful subliminal channel, right? Okay. Right, ways to get, there are subliminal channels in public key systems. In theory, you can build Trojan public key hardware. You can build Trojan copies of PGP. People have done this. What's the status of them? They're there, be careful. They're not going away. Take your T-shirt. What systems have to have subliminal channels? Known subliminal channels? None of them. They're all unknown. You know, it's really not kosher to leak key bits when you. You know, lots of products have been suspected of doing this, of leaking key bits. There are some that have been done, above board. Lotus Notes did that. Compromise encryption scheme. They basically leaked key bits to the government. But they said, we're leaking key bits to the government. Nobody bought it. They stopped doing it. So luckily the market dealt with that. The hat is better than the red card, sorry. Yeah, security is a chain. Asked about implementation versus the algorithm. This is tough. I mean, and you can think about it for security of a house. Does it make sense to look at the door lock or to look at the whole house and see how many doors there are? Everything's important. What we learn in our analyses we do is you look at everything. It has to be DES. It has to be good. The implementation also has to be good. The entry mechanism to collect the key has to be good. Security is a chain, and the weakest link will break it. And that's... You know, that's the unfortunate truth, and this is why it's very hard to buy secure products. I can hold up two products, they both use the same algorithm, make the same marketing claims, one is secure, one isn't, and the consumers have no idea which is which. And they can't tell. It's very much like buying drugs or buying airline safety or buying many things where the consumers don't have the expertise. So, you know, it all has to be looked at. All right, you and then behind you. Yeah. The question is, will ever be a time when two people communicate in a really secure manner? And, you know, the time was 100 years ago. Right? 100 years ago, you and I could walk out into an empty field, look around, and see nobody, and be absolutely 100% confident that we were not being overheard. Period. No exceptions. And that's a level of security we've actually lost in society forever, simply because of technology. Right? We can use cryptography to secure communication links, but someone could put a room bug. We can sweep for room bugs, but someone could do something else. We're at the point now where in order to be secure, with whatever that means, you have to trust somebody. You have to trust the software manufacturer, the computer manufacturer, the people who built the house, the person who comes in and delivers the mail. Any one of these people could, in theory, undermine the security of your system. So sort of the meta answer from a philosophical point of view is no, because no one will ever uninvent shotgun microphones. But in a real sense, you know, for normal people who aren't going to have multi-million-dollar sting operations against them, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of stuff you can do to make it much harder. But really, technology exists, and it will never go away. So you will never have pre-technology security. That's from some TV show I don't watch.
Exactly. Last year, one of the things you talked about was an algorithm that you could keep in your head, and security was partially based on that.
Oh, this is cool. That's a good ending question. Thanks a lot. He's asking about Solitaire, which I couldn't tell you about last year. So one other thing, what? Yeah, it's right here. It's waiting for you. So one of the things I've been working on is an algorithm that an agent can use in the field without effectively Bulgarious tools, without a computer with a copy of PGP on it. And I spent a lot of time with this, a bunch of years, looking at pocket calculators and various things. Eventually came up with the notion that a deck of cards is a really clever way to hold a permutation. 54 factorial, including the jokers. Told this to Neil Stevenson about 2.5-3 years ago. And he worked it into Cryptonomicon. The algorithm is called Solitaire. I have an appendix in his book. And I think it's really cool. This is hard to do. This algorithm is not easy. The model I used was a Soviet pencil and paper cipher that I think a Czech defector explained to the world at some point. It's in David Kahn's book, Kahn on Codes. I tried working with it. It takes a good few hours to decrypt a 400-500 character message. This is not something that goes very quickly. So that was the sort of time frame I worked on. So Solitaire is not easy. It takes a lot of work to do. But effectively, you're manipulating a deck of cards. It's similar in spirit to RC4. It's an output feedback mode stream cipher that uses a large permutation to hold a state. And it produces a key stream that you You add modulo 26 to your letters to get the ciphertext and subtract to get the plain text. It's not perfect. I would not use this cipher for large data streams. I would not encrypt video with it. I would not encrypt computer data with it. I would encrypt 400 character messages with it. You got to change the key with each message. But, you know, for pencil and paper applications where, you know, you're not going to give the enemy a lot of plain text, a lot of ciphertext, where you're not going to be able to do related key attacks, I think it's robust and strong. And it's okay, that I guess that's probably the coolest thing I've done recently, whoever asked that. And the description's in the book. It's in the last few pages. It's part of the plot. I won't explain to you how it's used in the plot. It's actually a good book. I did some signings with Neil. Science fiction authors get way better groupies than cryptographers do. So I give it as a personal challenge to you guys to change that. And I'm coming out with a paper on it probably at a conference sometime next year, which we'll talk about. The book is Cryptonomicon by Neil Stephenson. It's like a New York Times bestseller. It's about cryptography. It's about cryptography and internet and startups and World War II and gold. And Neil, I mean, his plots are, yeah, but he writes a beautiful paragraph. The man is a stunning stylist. All right, this is going to be the last question. And we will take someone we haven't took before from the back. Yeah, the person who pointed at the person. There we go. So you get your allies. For the last T-shirt.
Have you heard of zero knowledge systems?
Zero knowledge just has their own hour to talk about their stuff, so that doesn't count as a question. You didn't get a T-shirt. Oh, now we are going to... Oh, from all the way to the side. I didn't go anybody from the side.
Any comments on the matrix-based system developed by the young lady?
Okay, yeah, this is about Sarah Flannery, the 16-year-old... cryptography genius who came up with the algorithm that every newspaper on the planet talked about. And this is your T-shirt. This is really actually a very sad... the story has not played out because we've never seen the algorithm. But I believe it's going to actually be a very sad story. Sarah Flannery, who's probably a brilliant 16-year-old, invented a cryptographic system, I believe while as a summer student at Baltimore Technologies. And she like immediately whisked off into some soundproof chamber and told to patent it. So this is why we're not seeing it. In the press, it was told, you know, this will replace RSA, and it's faster and better and zippier, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. A few details leaked out. We think it's very much like some of the Matrix stuff that Jacques Patrain in France has done and Ari Shamir has broken. We're not actually sure. I believe that, you know, within 48 hours of it being released, it's going to be broken by someone like Ari. We've seen a lot of algorithms in this general area. They don't seem to withstand analysis. But really, unfortunately, because the press built this up as such a big deal, when it comes out and it's broken, it will be such a big deal. And we actually might lose a potentially extremely brilliant cryptographer just out of embarrassment. And this is sad. I mean, you know, well, I think what I told the press comment I made is sort of, the minus is that this will probably be broken in the days of release, but the plus is she probably actually is a brilliant 16-year-old girl. And my hope is that she will like us anyway after we trash her system. And with that, I think I'm throwing it off the stage. So thanks for coming. I will be around. So you get 10 extra points on the groupie scale.